everyone. Welcome to the Steve Maxwell Drums Podcast. Don't forget to check us out on our website at www.maxwelldrums.com and then our reverb stores at Steve Maxwell Drums-Chicago and Steve Maxwell Drums-New York. We also have social media, two Instagram accounts, at Maxwell Drum Shop Chicagoland and then at Maxwell Drum Shop. And then also on Facebook, Steve Maxwell and Steve Maxwell Drum Shop. And then, of course, check us out on Twitter, at Maxwell Drum Shop. We will interview players, collectors, drum and cymbal builders, and also teachers about all things percussion. And you can go to YouTube if you want to see the video. We'll have pictures of drum shops, drum sets, badges, cymbals, all kinds of fun stuff. So let's get started. We hope you enjoy it. 3, 2, 1. Today, we have Dave Victor. And he's been a friend of the shop, friend of our family for quite a while. We go all the way back to, I think the first time I remember interacting with you is when you bought my marimba. Remember that a while back?
I think you bought my marimba.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I bought it from you. Yeah, I didn't sell it to you.
Yeah, it was an old Leedy 3.5 octave.
Yeah. And I wish I never would have sold that.
I know, me too. Yeah, I'm glad it went to you, but yeah, that was actually a great instrument.
It would be here if I would have held on to it, but it was one of those ones that was unique because it had the accidental keys were angled slightly down, mm-hmm. which I've never seen before.
Yeah, I picked that up from Century Mallet, maybe my sophomore year of high school.
And that's for those who don't know, in the old Deegan building.
Correct.
Gilberto, right?
Gilberto Cerna. Yeah, he was the guy that worked there and did all the refurbishing. He was kind of the expert. He had worked at Deegan, so right. Yeah, really knowledgeable guy. And then Gilberto sold it to a guy named Andy, who's doing a great job with it now. So
nice.
Yeah, still going, still thriving.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Dave, right now, what's your position called at Craviato? It kind of changes from, I don't know what you're actually called at this point.
So when I started in 2010, I was general manager. And I did that for a number of years, 6 years. And in 2016, I was vice president of sales and marketing. So it's a small company. Everybody wears a lot of hats.
You kind of just do a little bit of everything.
I do artist relations. I do backline. I do sales.
You're my rep, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I help service all the dealers. I service all the drummers in the community that need stuff.
Or, I know our customers, a lot of them even have your number.
Well, that's right. A lot of Craviato, we're small enough. And that's what people like about the company in some ways. They'll reach out directly to me, and then I can help them find a dealer that's closest to them or whatever. So,
right.
And I love that. I love working with the end user. And sometimes, we get to really dial in what they want. So when they actually get the instrument, they like it. They're happy with it.
We can talk more about Craviato. First off, I want to talk about you a little bit. So, sure. Tell me a little bit about your history. You're from Wheaton, right? The
Correct.
Same city as me. I went to your house like one time. It may have been when I bought the marimba from you, and I do remember that. But yeah, tell me a little bit about what school? What school did you go to?
For high school?
Yeah.
I grew up in Wheaton. My parents moved from Elmhurst to Wheaton in 1986.
Okay.
So I went through, finished elementary, middle, and high school in Wheaton. Went to Wheaton Warrenville South.
Are your parents musicians?
No. My dad was a teacher. He worked out here, actually close to the shop in Bloomingdale.
Huh.
And then my mom was stayed at home and raised us, and then ended up going to be an office manager, basically, when I was in middle school. So
nice.
Yeah.
And then so with your parents not being musicians, how did you get into music and percussion? And did you do any other instruments? Or
my mom played drums as a young, in fifth or sixth grade or whatever in elementary school. But even though they weren't musicians, they both had a deep respect and passion for music. So some music was always on. Every time we were in the car, there was music. Every time we were in the house, there was music.
Were they like classic rock?
Yeah, more or less. My dad, I grew up on the Doors and, all sorts of stuff. Jimi Hendrix. My mom was more kind of folksy rock.
Bob Dylan?
Some of that. 60s, definitely oldies, a lot of oldies. I even remember my dad working, like grading papers on Friday nights, and they used to have something called the Friday Night 50s Party. And
cool.
So, I mean, I would just be up and doing whatever, and that was
swinging.
Always on. Yeah, definitely. So, and then actually even like diverse stuff. I remember my dad playing, like liking Vivaldi, early classical music.
Yeah,
and definitely theater music, which is why I love playing theater so much now, as I grew up on a lot of Broadway musicals. So
I think you told me once your first love was kind of the drum set.
Yeah.
And then you have like a more of a classical background than I do.
You and I shared a teacher. Yeah, we both studied with Michael Folker, who's a
great teacher.
Great
very,
teacher.
Very awesome. I learned so much from him.
Yeah.
I miss Mike. I wish I could run into him every now and then. He never comes out to the shop. Does he still live in Wheaton?
No, he is not at College of DuPage anymore. He's at Judson in one of the suburbs in Elgin.
If you're listening, Mike, I miss you, man. You should come to the shop. We're in Glendale Heights one of these days.
Yeah, no, I owe a lot to him. He was definitely a mentor, big time, and just kind of took my drum set skills, honed them, and then brought me full circle.
When did you start studying with him?
Eighth grade, yeah.
Cool. And then at that point, you probably did band. Did you do marching band? Because I think you went to Wheaton World South,
right? I did. There was no way out.
Sure. And you had Schmecka. I talked a little bit about our marching band in one of the other ones, but he was the
right.
And he was a good teacher.
Yes.
No, we wasn't messing around.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, he was serious. Yeah. No, I had a great experience at South. My favorite thing to do there was they had a show choir. Like, this is before Glee.
I think I remember that, yeah.
Like, before show choirs on TV were popular. And we used to compete. And we even would go in. There was a studio in Wheaton where a bunch of even famous songs were recorded. And they'd bring the band in. They would record. And they'd bring the choir in. And every year you'd put out a tape, or every
was
couple
that,
of years.
Was that, part of the main hall?
Yeah. So right next to the band room was the choir room. And so when I was in South, I did marching band. And then I did usually the musicals there, and then jazz band.
So were you in choir. Were you in the line? Did you actually do the marching?
I did. So my first
was Weber there in charge of it at that point?
No. Now
so
this
is before him, and he was the Cavaliers guy that really made us like. Did you guys have those nice Yamaha drums? Or that's probably, I think he got those.
Yeah,
you guys
I was
probably
were,
marching with
yeah,
some old stuff.
And it was, you know, marching drums have come a long way. My freshman year, I auditioned and they put me on quads.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I love quads.
Not quints, but quads. And it was weird because I was really small. And at that time, they were really heavy.
Sure.
And so it was like, it was a brutal.
That'll
brutal
give you
experience.
Some back pain.
Yeah. So that was kind of crazy. And then sophomore year through senior year, I marched snare. And I think my junior and senior year for sure, I was drum captain my senior year.
That's awesome, man.
So yeah, that was, you know, it was great experience. And actually, you know, having those types of chops are something I've never regretted, having that experience.
Sure.
And like playing that way musically. I think a lot of good comes out of that. I mean, it wasn't something I would want to make a career out of personally, but I take the experience and look upon it well.
Yeah, it's definitely like a real, that marching scene. I remember the kids like get all being in a circle, and like one guy would play a rudiment, then the other guy would match it and maybe do it a little faster to add something, and then the next guy, and it would be like it was very, very competitive.
Yeah, it's a thing, you know, for sure. Even I have an orchestral job, and the timpanist there marched in the Cavaliers, and a great orchestral musician, but also great time, great technique. I think a lot of that comes from marching, is, you know, having very strong fundamental technique and chops.
Right on.
Yeah, South was good. I mean, I no regrets. That was great. I studied with Folker at COD from eighth grade through high school, and went into college as more of a drum set player. And really found I liked classical music, really became passionate about it my freshman year in college. And at that point, I was kind of behind other students in like marimba playing, formal marimba playing, some of that stuff. So I really had to work hard the rest of my undergrad to kind of get where I needed to be.
Yeah, you've got great mallet chops.
Oh, thanks, man.
And then I've heard you play a little bit of vibes, and yeah, you get some nice vibes, voicings.
Thank you.
So then, which college did you go to?
I went to Roosevelt for my undergrad.
Right, yeah, we went to a lot of the same schools.
Yeah. And at that time, there was a guy there named Ed Perimba, who was principal timpanist of the Lyric. And
that was before Ed Harrison.
Correct. Yeah, so Primbo was there for my first 3 years. Ed Harrison came my senior year.
It's so funny, man. We like...
It's kind of overlapped.
Yeah. I went to the academy for a while in the city, but other than that, we went to the same exact school.
Yeah.
Did you like Roosevelt? Did you have a good time there?
Yeah, it was great. It's a small enough program. It's very strong reputation. But small enough that we all got experience. Again, I would do the theater stuff there.
Did you have Mark Cozy as a theater
teacher? Yeah, as fantastic. A theater. Yeah, he was fantastic.
Really, the passion just was like oozing out of the guy.
Absolutely. it was awesome. The whole experience there. And just living in the city, I got a job.
HCC?
Yes, Herman Crown
Center. That's where I met Madeline.
Oh, that's crazy.
It wasn't the nicest dorm. But no. I got to stay in the new super dorm that they built, which was like brand new. Yeah, we had fondue once. They just had extra money they had to get rid of, and they had a big chocolate fondue.
Yeah, we didn't have anything like that.
Right. HCC, I did spend a lot of time there, and it was, cinder block walls.
It wasn't a place, which was great.
Bars on the windows, literally.
Yeah, literally. So you wanted to be in the practice room. You didn't want to go back to your room. So.
And it was, one cool thing, it was connected to the school, so you didn't have to go outside, which is kind of a little bit of a good thing.
Especially in Chicago winters and stuff. It was nice to just travel through the hallways and get to where you needed to be. it was great. I mean, the whole faculty and staff.
This would have been when you were going to college. Well, what were the years?
I graduated in 01
with
my bachelor's, yeah.
So I guess that would have, at that point, I was in the city, but I was going to the academy.
You're in high school, yeah.
And the drum shop was kind of just getting started in the Fine Arts Building.
Right. So I think your dad really opened up the shop when I was out. I moved out to Boston for my master's in 2001. And I think that's when the store really kind of opened up and took off.
How did you first meet my dad? Was it the drum show, maybe? Or?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think so.
Because I have no idea.
Oddly enough, your parents' backyard and my in-laws' backyard almost meet up. So my wife actually grew up like a street away from you guys. So I don't know. I guess at a drum show, my dad brought me to the Chicago show when I was really, really young.
Sure.
Like a long time ago. And then I remember buying a drum, coming to your house.
I just barely remember this. I think I remember hey Dave, how's it going, man?
Yeah, your dad was just so great and so I mean, he was just passionate, showing me. I think he had Buddy Rich's kit set up at that point.
Do you remember which drum you bought from him first?
Yeah, I bought a DW anniversary, very much like a Craviato. It had the inlay. It had an inlay in the middle. It's the 25th anniversary drum.
Nice.
6.5 by 14. Yeah, I remember it well.
You probably don't have it anymore.
No, I don't, unfortunately. I don't. No, first kit I bought there, I bought a Camco Oak Lawn kit.
Nice.
When I graduated high school, I bought that from, it was a refinish. It was not expensive, but it sounded amazing. And then I bought that drum.
Probably the best vintage drums out there.
Ridiculous. And I think I paid...
Sound-wise, it just sounds so good.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. That's another one I wish I had. I mean, we could talk all podcast about what we sold and wish we didn't, but people would lose interest. But I came over to the house and he was awesome and ended up buying that drum. I like that drum the most. It was between that and kind of a prototype Ludwig drum.
Interesting. So yeah, that's cool. And you were probably at that point, what were you, like 17?
Yeah, a little older than that, but yeah, not super old.
And then a little later, we had the marimba, where I bought the marimba from you that we were talking about earlier. That I wish I had never sold again.
That was great. They just don't sound like that anymore. The quality of rosewood and all that stuff. There's a reason those sound great.
So at Roosevelt, you had a really good teacher. And you're like a classical major, so.
Right. Yeah. So I it was a great program. I could do a lot, but I think my focus was my recitals were all classically based.
Right.
I did the Bartok Sonata for two pianos, percussion, a bunch of other stuff. Ed Harrison was amazing.
You had both Parimba and Harrison?
Yeah. So Parimba retired my senior year.
Cool.
And Harrison came in. They had a search, a number of candidates, and Harrison came in and got it.
Ed is great, man.
Oh, he's amazing.
He's so, like, just humble. Like, so, some classical guys that can be,
They're great, but they can be a little bit uptight. But man, Ed is just like, he's the kind of guy you just like want to, have like a, you know, go grill, like, you know, have a barbecue with, you know what right. I mean? He used to invite everyone over. I think it was for some holiday that he would always invite everyone over to his place. I never went, but I wish I would have.
He was awesome. I've been lucky. Everybody I've ever studied with has been well-rounded. They haven't just been like orchestrally driven. So Harrison is a great jazz vibes player.
Yeah,
He's a world-class maraca player.
Right.
Amazing timpanist, good drum set player, amazing percussionist. I mean,
he did a maraca concerto. Yeah. When I was there, mm-hmm. with the percussion ensemble. It was very cool.
He's ridiculous. And before he won the timpani job at Lyric, he was a percussionist. I mean, there's not a lot of guys that can do both that well and win a job doing it. So, I mean, it's a great program. If people are listening and thinking about going to a school, I definitely say that's one to check out.
Yeah, right on, man. I met Madeline there. She's my wife.
Yeah.
We both have families now.
That's true.
Yeah, we're... And now we're all stuck in our houses.
Yeah, homeschooling.
Getting restless. Exactly. Yours are a little older than mine. Mine are young enough that they probably are, we try to like play little games, but I don't have to worry about a curriculum yet.
Right.
A particular one that is. We're still doing like matching game.
Right.
Which is great fun.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Then after college, did you like, you must have like right away, you moved to like Minnesota for a while?
I did. I moved back. I did a kind of a post-grad study with Ted Akatz, who was principal of Chicago Symphony. And again, Ted could play anything.
That was still in Chicago?
It was in Chicago, yeah. And then I got married, and my wife, her internship brought us up to Minnesota. So we moved up there. It was supposed to be kind of a one-year thing, and I started playing with the orchestra there. I won a regional orchestra job, started breaking into the theater scene. She was doing really well. She was working at the University of Minnesota Hospitals, doing great there. So we ended up sticking around.
Nice.
So we were there 5 years.
Yeah, I've heard pretty much only good things about that area. Like, it's like, what's the city?
We were in Minneapolis.
Yeah, Minneapolis. Yeah, my roommate in college, I think he was from up there.
Yeah, it's great.
Seems like a nice place.
I miss it. I still have a lot of friends up there and keep in touch. Cold. Very cold. Yeah. If you can get through winter, though, you're rewarded with spring, summer, and fall are pretty spectacular.
So you were up there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then back to Chicago, though. Do you remember the first time you came into the shop?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was literally my destination point. Anytime I came back through town, I mean, that was like, I got to go there.
So not while you were at Roosevelt, it was kind
of... No, yeah, it wasn't the shop.
You might have not even known it was
there. No, I think your dad was still doing it out of the house while I was at Roosevelt. Yeah. I mean, which is probably a good thing. I would have spent all my money there being so close to Roosevelt. But yeah, anytime I came back in when I was in grad school or afterward. I mean, I remember buying Rodney Green's 22-inch Bosphorus hammer that he traded in for a Spiz there. I remember buying my first Craviato there. I came in looking for a Radio King, and this is right when Johnny started, and your dad had some NAMM drums and was like, oh, you know, you can play this Radio King, but check this out. And he pulled a 7x14 mahogany with nickel-plated hardware.
Oh man, that's awesome!
And I put a stick on it and was like done.
It's just I'll take it.
And that was it, man. That was the bite, and the addiction for me has lasted.
Sure.
I'm, yeah, fortunate to be working with Graviato still, but I got it the first time I heard it. I understood what it was and how it was different, and that would have been 2004 or 5, maybe January of 2005 or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, actually, I think it was. I came in for an audition. And stop by the shop. So
I might have even run into you because I would have just have started going to Roosevelt at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I miss that building. Although there are disadvantages to it. The elevators were kind of a little bit of a pain to ship stuff in and stuff like that.
Logistically, it was tough. Yeah,
a little bit of a challenge. Sure. But just so beautiful and so unchanged in the last 100 mm-hmm. years.
Right.
They had. The Fine Arts Building. If anyone's ever in Chicago, definitely go check it out.
Yeah, for sure.
You can just go in and mm-hmm. you know, take the elevator up to the 10th floor, just walk the stairs down, and every floor is like a different artist. You'll hear people singing in the hallways.
Yeah.
And
there's a world-renowned violin shop in there.
You know, it's actually kind of cool. The old space where the drum shop was, now the Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra which my wife, that's her organization. They have their steel pan and percussion stuff right in there. So that space is still being used for
absolutely,
which is kind of cool.
It was a great room, too. That room sounded great when you played in there. It just, you know, big old, and open. And
old buildings are like that. Yeah, we've got the studio, so I'm always like researching on how to try and make spaces sound good. And yeah, a bit like old buildings, they have a lot of natural materials like the wood floor.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have those ornate like baseboards,
right.
And then that what that kind of acts as is a bit of like plaster work.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a sound diffuser, so it takes the sound waves and makes them so they kind of shoot in all different directions, so you don't get really distracting echoes, but mm-hmm. it's still nice resonant. But
yeah,
that's why the old buildings, old houses, they have like a sound to them
for sure. Yeah. That was definitely a special place.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people look forward to coming down there and checking out the shop.
And so probably, what was it, around like 2008, 2009, that's when the shop moved. And then, yeah, tell me a little bit about like starting it in Naperville.
Yeah, so when I first came on, it was I helped to kind of move it out back towards the suburbs, closer to home for your dad. And easier with parking, you know, at that time.
And New York had been opened.
I
know it was.
A couple years.
Yeah, before you started, for a while, what I was doing, like always, because I would always help out at the shop, I was just shipping stuff to New York all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then that became kind of the main focus at that point.
Right. And so we were doing kind of a similar model here where Illinois was open a couple days a week. There was a lot of shipping. We were running a lot of sales through there, but it wasn't open to the public
most days,
Most days, right? So we did that, and you know,
I'm gonna have to say I do miss the main room of the Naperville.
Yeah, it was beautiful, wasn't it?
I really love that.
Yeah, the beautiful windows.
It used to be like a fan store, so they had these
wood beams, and they had all the lighting up. Yeah, it was a really cool, cool spot actually.
We needed to move though. This place is awesome. Now we needed the space, and
you have the big warehouse now. Yeah. I mean, there's a million reasons. But it was cool. There was a Starbucks at the end of the.
Which they closed.
I know.
When I started.
I know. Which is just that's unfortunate.
That's half the reason we probably moved.
We used to bring coffee in on Saturdays, and it was a lot of fun. I had a blast there always. Yeah, it was really cool. So and then
of course the drum shows.
Sure. That
was always a big thing for Illinois every year. Yeah, it's really too bad. It looks like they've canceled it for this year. But it seems it's going to go back to the.
I saw that King County,
which will be that'll be kind of cool.
Yeah,
I didn't mind the new space, but the King County place was just really nice. It was just, mm-hmm. It's a brand new facility and very clean.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, it's sad this year, but I totally given the coronavirus and everything, I understand why he made that choice. But
I don't think there was really any other option. People have to commit, and there's a lot of international people too,
for sure.
And so they're definitely not going to be making it out. Yeah,
right. It's we're all going to get together in 2021 and have a blast out there. So
yeah,
that'll be fun.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was looking forward to interviewing some people like Mike Corrado and the guys who usually come through. But it's okay. In this time, we can just get our local local people up, such as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got to do something, you know?
Absolutely.
But yeah, so then you started with Craviato.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, just tell me about it.
Boy, my first trip out there. So I knew Johnny a little bit from the drum shows and stuff like that. My first trip to California, Johnny took me around, I think, 2 of the 3 days. He drove me around the Bay Area.
Nice.
And he would show me, places he used to play. He would show me native plants, ice plant or what, and just, he just took me around. We went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium,
Yeah, he's
just
a really fun guy.
He was, and he just wanted to kind of get to know me. And it was great. We go out to dinner at night and just kind of during the day I'd come, and towards the end of that week, he kind of showed me the process and how to roll and what I got to meet everybody and what everybody did. And, it was kind of, I guess I was tasked with just trying to get wrap my head around that and try to find ways to areas to make improvements and to make production more. And, we tripled production basically after 2 years, and after 3 years, we had it up significantly more than that. So, you know, it was great. All those people there, and just having the ability to work with Johnny was awesome.
Was Greg already working there when you?
Greg precedes me, yeah. So he started
not by too long, but
no, he was there before I was.
He, for those who don't know, he used to make the Maxwell drums for us, which is right. There aren't too many of them out there, but you see him from time to time. I see him pop up on like eBay and.
Greg is great. He before that he had Drum Solo, which
right that was his. And some people we had one of his kits here for a little while ago. Yeah. Really well made.
Yeah, beautiful. A lot of stave construction, some solid shell stuff as well, but and then some ply stuff. I mean, it just varied. He was custom, but good painter, understands lacquers and painting, and machined his own hardware by hand. All his tube lugs he made. So, I mean,
I didn't even know that.
He came to Craviato with a really good head on his shoulders on how to do stuff. So when I started, it was Eric Gunn was the oldest employee. Johnny was the oldest, but Eric used to help Johnny. And Eric built all the timeless timbers. When Johnny was still doing this in his garage, Eric was helping him. So this Johnny and Eric went back to the 80s. And then Saul, Johnny brought on Saul, I think, next. Then Greg. Then there was a young guy named Jordan Ackerman, really smart kid, really into machining and understood all the way the big lathes and all that stuff worked, had some great ideas. And as committed to his process as Johnny was, I think Johnny did listen to Jordan and definitely took his input seriously. And then there were a couple office guys. Joe Kenny was up there for a long time. When I first started, I was a dealer. I should preface this. I was a Craviato dealer in Minnesota and from 2005, 6, and 7 up until I moved in 09. I would do just very, very little.
So this is before you worked at Maxwell Drums?
Correct.
The Naperville shop.
I used to run a school bid business. So I worked at a place. It was a double reed specialty shop. And there was a percussion shop there that I helped run, but my primary responsibility there was school fulfillment and procurement.
And you actually did some schools by Craviatos?
No, not Craviatos, but we would sell timpani, marimbas, tambourines, sample box, all that stuff, and sleigh bells, you name it. I mean, we would have huge, huge contracts. And I would do all the percussion sourcing, and then I would do all the bidding and all that stuff.
So you were like a dealer. If they wanted, basically, they could get it.
Yeah, and then I had, you know, at that time, the Twin Cities didn't really have a kind of a boutique-y type drum shop. So we did a couple Craviato drums. It wasn't, I mean, there was nowhere near the volume we run through Maxwell Drums. But it was onesies, twosies here and there for local guys. And just trying to spread the word. At that time, Johnny was still pretty new. Everybody knew his DW stuff.
Right.
But, you know, Craviato, Johnny went out on his own in 2004. So it was pretty early.
So 2004. And then what was the, do you know the years around Solid? Was that just...
That was in the 80s. Yeah, that
was
way
before. So
that was
a while back.
Yeah.
Those are cool drums.
Very cool. Yeah, and actually, Johnny's part suppliers were up in the Twin Cities for that. His die casting companies that he used for that. So and Johnny,
for those who don't know, the Solid was their drums that you'll see them. They're pretty rare though.
Pretty rare, yeah.
Very similar shell to the later Craviatos, and they had really kind of heavy duty hardware.
Heavy duty hardware, die cast tubes, most of them. Kind of a round, really cool design lug.
Yeah.
And Johnny was doing that. So he actually found a decent amount of wood in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota. So he had ties to that area, oddly enough. And so, I mean, Johnny was a fascinating person.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and the office was Joe Kenny, and then Nathaniel Mila was there. So it just, you know, a number of employees, but, you know, it was great times working there.
Yeah, definitely. Johnny was great. I miss him. I really only saw him during the drum shows. Mm-hmm. Then I went to one NAMM show where I got to hang out with him. We went and you were there to that Italian restaurant.
Oh right, yeah. he was a character. Yeah, I mean I miss him. I think about him every day. I really do. Yeah. He was, you know,
He really enjoyed life, I think.
One of a kind. Yeah. I mean, oddly enough, weird story today. I have a couple of cards Johnny sent me just with notes in them. And for some reason, my son was going through like a box I had in my room and pulled one out today. And I was like, oh, it's signed from Johnny. So it was a good memory. But
Trail of destruction.
Yeah, exactly. Like, hey,
what's this?
This is Daddy's special box.
For sure.
But it was
Arthur cool. ate a marker the other day. He looks up at me and his entire face is blue and he spits it out and he's just like, it's so funny.
The joys of parenthood, right?
Yeah. Exactly. You look like the Joker. but so cool, man. And then Craviato now, I mean, because Johnny passed away, how many years ago is that?
Johnny passed away July of 2016.
So, time really flies.
Yeah, it's almost 4 years. It does fly. So, we kept it in California, June or July of 2019, they made the decision to move it, to Nashville.
Right.
So... when your dad acquired Forks, I think there was it definitely made sense to bring it to the Midwest for a lot of distribution.
A little bit of an easier place to do business.
Yeah, absolutely. Easier to do business, closer, kind of in the center of the country, easy to ship stuff out, and a bulk of wood, the majority of our natural resources are here.
Right.
In the Midwest, meaning, so.
Yeah, and so things are getting geared up at this point. Just maybe talk a little bit about like where we're at and the future and,
It's great. Saul and Greg made the move. A couple of the guys didn't. And they brought on Sam Bacco, who's kind of running production there. He's in the Slingerland book because he tried to bring back Slingerland there. And then he brought back Leedy, so two of the books exactly in front of us.
Right, yeah.
he's with Craviato now, doing a great job. We have another guy there, Zach, who's helping with all the processes, but primarily does a lot of shipping. And
we're snares are coming out right now, pretty much, right? We're not quite making a lot of kits at this point.
Kits are coming out. Both are coming out. We, we moved to Nashville with a huge order queue, over 500 drums to be made, which, when everything's handmade, that takes time.
Right.
Things are ramped up and they're getting there. And I mean, fortunately for us, Saul and Greg really worked hard prior to the move and rolled a bunch of shells. So we were able to come into Nashville with a nice backstock of product that we could work with, and a lot of wood. I went out and did a big wood pull. Was that 2018? I think I bought, close to 20,000 board feet of maple or something.
Yeah, you should talk about the process of finding the wood a little bit.
Yeah.
Something you're heavily involved with. There's a couple videos you've done on that, and I think people would definitely like to hear about that.
I learned from Greg and Johnny. I went on a couple of wood pulls with Johnny. There's a specific things you look for when you're pulling wood, but anytime you steam bend and roll something, the natural tendency of wood is not to bend. So you really have to be careful in what you're selecting. So you look for certain imperfections. Certain grain patterns, the way the board, the runoff of the grain, the way the cathedrals are on the end of the board. Sometimes it's challenging because depending on the species, it might not be faced. So a board might not be kind of planed or cut down, resawn, so you can actually see what you're looking for. So it's challenging.
What was Johnny's favorite wood to work with?
It's a good question to work with. If you ask Johnny what you should get, he would probably steer you towards maple if your first kit. I think he enjoyed working with maple, and Johnny's kit, personal set, was a maple kit.
Right, and that was like the first.
I think so. It was the prototype.
Right,
one of the prototypes.
Zero.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a blue gunmetal sparkle. So I mean, that kit.
Which is funny. It's funny that they would do a lacquer kit being the woodworker.
Amazing, yeah. But that kit sounded great. I'm really, really great. you know, Johnny had his favorite sizes, and, you know, I think on Craviato, shallower sizes, on like, I love 12 by 20s or 12 by 22s. Johnny loved a 4.5 by 14. He liked that snare drum size a lot.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, four and a half is a great craft size. Because the solid shell, they tune up or tune down. You get a lot of range.
Yeah, so, yeah. I love solid shell drums. I mean, yeah, we should probably talk about what makes them special. I think that they just, in my opinion, it's a thinner shell, and then it doesn't have the glue, which is something that glue is a little sonically less pleasing. And it's just, they have like this fundamentally kind of warm, a little bit lower tone, in my opinion, which makes it so that like a Craviato drum, even if you tune it up high, it still has this like body to it.
Right.
And then if you tune it low, then they just sound absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, yeah, talk a little bit more about the qualities of single ply.
I'm always careful about this because every manufacturer makes good instruments these days.
Sure.
What differentiates Craviato is the solid shell. So we glue up our shells where they roll over. It's called a scarf joint. So where they come over, we glue them at that point. So there's minimal glue on the shell, allowing the shell to really resonate and open up like a bell. Like if you were to hit a bell, you'd feel the whole thing vibrate.
Right.
It's a musical chamber, you know, the solid shell. And then we also glue the re-rings in. So there's, compared to a plied shell where you're gluing pieces of plywood together, it's just a different concept, different structure. And so they're going to perform differently.
Yeah, all you have to do is just take a ply kit and then take a Craviato and just tap the shells.
Oh, yeah.
It's just night and day.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's its own thing. You know, and I think Johnny's formula on how to make it from start to finish, it's a 21-step process. And I think that process is really golden, you know, which is why... people that have them, it's an heirloom instrument. You know, we don't see a lot of them come back. People are happy with them. The quality's there. It's the utmost in craftsmanship. So it starts at picking the wood. So, I mean, instead of calling a supplier to get a drum shell and then drilling and assembling a drum shell, we're going out and picking the wood from the very first step.
I'll put a link in the description to the video because there's one on the Craviato YouTube thing where people, it's just you kind of going through wood. That's posted, I think, right?
Yeah. So when I was up in Michigan, I think I was up in Michigan Northern Michigan for that. And it was, like a week-long trip. Just those boards are huge and you're just, it's like an assembly line. They're just constant that you're doing that. You're exhausted at the end of the day. Greg has done it. I've done it. You know, Eric Gunn used to do it a little bit. Johnny's done it. So that's the formula. If the material you're starting with isn't superior, then it's not going to, I mean, you're not going to save it at the 18th step. It's got to be right from step one.
They can even, like you said, if it's a little imperfection, they can even crack.
Absolutely.
That's a big waste.
And there's definitely loss. Anytime you steam bend something, there's going to be loss.
Right.
But it's also, customers are getting something that's made specifically for them, you know, from start to finish. And it's kind of a cool thing in that regard.
So was Johnny's, did he really like Slingerlands and Leedy, the old single ply drums? Is that kind of what inspired him to start? Because this would have been back in the 80s, like the Solid Company.
Yeah.
And
so,
then later Craviato.
Yeah, I think so. You know, Johnny was a player. You know, I think that's a big thing that a lot of guys that work at Craviato are musicians. So
yeah, Johnny was like touring with.
Yeah, I mean, Johnny played with Neil Young. He played with Mark Knopfler. He was. Yeah. Rye Cooter, a Buffy St. Marie.
Yeah, yeah. Rye buys stuff from us sometimes.
Yeah, he does. Johnny. I mean, Johnny had he was a great drummer, and he understood music.
Yeah.
And I think as a drummer, that's why he loved working with artists, and the artist relations piece really turned Johnny on. He loved doing that. It was like a family to him. But I think, you know, as like all of us are, we like to hear new things and things we haven't experienced. We like to play and tinker with, and Johnny would do that. So he would go and he would check out old vintage drums, and he had kind of a restoration business in the Bay Area for a while. So like kind of like your dad would do, you'd get old drums and bring them back to life. Or you know, professionals would say, hey, can you dial this in? It just doesn't sound right. And Johnny would get the drum, maybe switch the strainer out, recut the edges, maybe recut the beds. do what he needed to do to make a drum playable again. So
was
Johnny,
he associated with the drum shop, or was it kind of just out of
No, I think it was freelance. Yeah, there's some stickers we put. Even I had the sticker, and I copied it, that we put it in the 2017 tribute drum when Johnny passed. It was like Johnny C. Restorations in Santa Cruz, California.
Cool.
Pretty cool. So, yeah, I mean, some and those pop up from time to time, some of the ones he worked on. But I think probably during this whole time, you know, he was working on Radio Kings. He was doing drum tech stuff at that time with Bill Gibson from Huey Lewis and the News, who was a partner of his at Solid. I know he had old leadies. One of Johnny and one of our last visits in 2016, Johnny kind of gave me the whole story of how some of those Huey albums were recorded and what drums were used.
Cool.
And Johnny was staying outside of where the drum show was, and I'd get up early and pick him up, and we'd drive in, and you know, I'll always cherish those, but, you know,
You're lucky you got to hang
out.
Yeah,
that was a cool experience, but, you know, I learned a lot, actually, in those car trips.
Sure.
So, but, yeah, I mean, just seeing his collection. And he would sometimes show me or send me pictures of, look at this, or I've worked on that, or, you know, he had old Premier drums. He had all sorts of duplex drums. He had all sorts of stuff.
So early on with Craviato, the first wood he worked with was maple.
Right.
And then when did they start doing other woods? Because I think there was the timeless timber, but that was still maple. And then the beautiful
right.
figured maple.
Early on, he was building with the after Solid Select. He kind of did his own thing. When that dissolved, he ended up building for DW for a period of time. And those were predominantly maple drums. There are some other, some cherries and... There's some other ones are out there and like very limited production.
A lot of those are stained maple.
Yes.
You find like a green one and a blue one out there.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff. Yeah. You know, but he's still experimenting. I mean, there's even Sitka Spruce DW drums out there.
Really?
Yeah, there's some interesting species. So Johnny was still kind of testing the waters, pushing the envelope. Yeah, trying to find new stuff. And I believe in 2004 he had the maple. But he also had bird's eye maple. He had ash. I think there's cherry, and I think there's mahogany.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, he was those are all kind of North American hardwoods, tone
yeah, the,
woods that.
And then the fourth that I think of as kind of the standard would be like the walnut.
Walnut, yeah. I don't know when exactly. I don't remember a walnut run very early on. I may be wrong.
I guess that would be fifth, actually, technically, because you had the ash in there.
The walnuts, it's its own thing. That's a cool thing about it. I mean, I think, you know, it's Craviato is kind of like a gateway company. You get in on a specific drum. Like if you took Johnny's recommendation, you might get in with a maple. So you might buy a Heritage. You start getting into that drum, getting to know it, and then you really understand what it can do and how you can tune it and the versatility of it and the potential in the instrument. And then it's like, well, I need a mahogany. I want a vintage sound, or I want something that's I want a 7x13 cherry, that I can really slam on. You know, and then it just goes from there, which is why we have so many repeat customers because of what the brand is.
Yeah, it's amazing how different the woods are, and it's you know, sometimes each wood is just kind of unique. It's not necessarily whether it's a harder wood or a softer wood. That doesn't equate necessarily to louder or softer when it comes to the volume. They're just kind of, each one is different.
They're like people. They have their own personalities.
Yeah, we should talk about them. But in my opinion, the cherry is kind of a little more in your face than the other woods. Maybe a little more projection. What do you think of cherry?
Yeah, I've heard different things. So I've heard, and this is more from like front of house, like, engineers is that the beech is really hot.
Beech, okay.
Birch. Birch. Yeah.
Because beech, like not too many of those out there.
Yeah, we didn't make many birch drums, but there are a couple kits out there, and I've heard that is like
very
hot, very intense.
We there's a video up if you want to hear a birch kit. I think there's one of my dad playing a birch kit.
Yeah, I know. YouTube. Some have come through the shop. Yeah, for sure.
I loved the birch. Yeah,
it sounds
so. Engineers like it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the hottest.
Oh, they said that that's the loudest and most in your face. And then would it be what
then
would be
Cherry
like?
From there?
Okay,
Cherry's got the most brittle kind of articulate highs. There's more highs in Cherry than there are in like walnut or mahogany.
But it's live. One of the most, not one of the most live drum. I don't even know how else to say it that I've ever played was a Craviato 6.5x14 Cherry with wood hoops.
Yeah,
that thing was just like, it just wanted to resonate.
Right. We had two kits made. One was Marcus Gilmore's and then like a clone kit. Johnny made two at the same time. And that drum set would shake the walls.
Yeah, man.
And it was like crazy. And I have a Cherry kit that Johnny made with shallower depths, and it's the same thing. I mean, when I pull that thing out, it's just like,
sure.
There's no ceiling. You can just go, you know? I mean, it's, I don't play that way. I don't have to, like, most rooms I play in are small or close mic'd, but there's definitely a vibe to the Cherry, which I really like.
Yeah.
And plus for me, it's a visual thing. I love the grain of a Cherry. I love the natural spots called pits in there. Mm-hmm. It's Mother Nature at its finest for me. And it darkens to a really nice burgundy-ish
color. They age well.
Right? Yeah.
So all the drums, too. Some of the maples that we have, like we have the kit mm-hmm. number one here, mm-hmm. not a prototype, but number one. That thing is like, mm-hmm. it's really, really just right. beautiful. Dark kind of it's even like gone from like kind of yellow to like brown.
Right. You guys have number one and two. Your dad has number two, and that is, if anyone's ever in the Chicago store here in Glendale Heights, play that snare drum in that kit. It's like it's like nothing else. It's unbelievable. It's so good.
So then from the top to the bottom, we got mm-hmm. birch on the top, then cherry. What would come next? In most.
Probably ash. Ash is very similar to maple with maybe a slightly longer note to it.
Yeah, I remember.
A little bit more sustained. Then maple's kind of right in the middle.
Yeah, man.
Then underneath maple for me is probably going to be a Euro beach, which is newer to us. We started messing around with that actually when Johnny was still around, 2016.
Makes me think sonar.
Yeah, it's got a vibe to it like that. It's a little bit darker. It's a little bit warmer.
Right.
And I'm thinking of like maybe like 70s sonars, you know, more of that kind of a vibe to it. The vintage stuff.
Right. Right.
And it's, but in solid shell form, you still get, it's its own thing, but it speaks a little bit lower, a little bit softer, a little bit warmer. Underneath the Euro beach is walnut, which is a little bit, it's dark and kind of muddy, lives in the low end for sure. And then underneath that is mahogany. And it's just softer, a little wispier, a little bit more quiet.
Yeah, kind of mahogany airy. Is quiet, right.
Yeah, it's like if you wanted to somehow get a solid shell version of a Rolling Bomber kit, then get a Craviato mahogany.
And poplar is kind of similar too, right?
Yeah, poplar is kind of, it's somewhere probably between walnut and mahogany. We did a vintage series briefly that had poplar.
Right.
I have a poplar kit. I love it. It's just really mellow.
Yeah, the white marine pearl one that we just did a video with. We had it outfitted with brass hoops and then calfskin heads.
Yeah.
It is just the quietest, most understated, kind of warm tone in a blind, like, you know, I would be able to choose that every time.
Right.
I know it was that one with that, you know.
Yeah, it's just, it's like a real musical instrument. It's like a great acoustic guitar or like a really good violin. It's just, it's the music that comes out of those shells are, and it's got a vibe, you know, very different. If you had that and like a 13, 16, 24 and you had a bobkit and maple, I mean, they're going to be just, you know.
Well, we should talk about bearing edges a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's three available.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got the baseball bat, which is like an old Slingerland pretty much.
Maybe. Correct. It's like a Ludwig Slingerland type edge. It's very, very rounded.
Right.
You know, and Johnny started experimenting with that. Oddly enough, he put first drum Johnny shared with me was a tom that he did. He was kind of working with an artist dialing something in.
It was one of those?
Yeah. And so we did that. And the first snare drum I saw, just to backtrack to what you just said, it was a 5x14 mahogany with calf heads.
And he
pulled it out of a drum bag, I think at a NAMM show, and was like, hey, what do you think of this? Really excited about it. I was like, I think you killed it. This is great. Sounds phenomenal. It has that thwack, that kind of meaty definition and sound attack to it.
Do you use Catskin for orchestral stuff?
On some drums, yeah, it depends. You know, if I'm doing an outdoor pops gig, I don't want to deal with it. But if I'm sure. like at the same concert hall and I know my environment and stuff, yeah, I'll
right. Yeah,
always they, opt for that.
They just melt into the mix.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, it's and it feels so great to play.
Right, right.
So yeah, Johnny has that. We have the standard 45.
And that's what probably most people should get. Because it's very versatile, you know, you can always muffle it a little more, but then
you can,
with
exactly.
the rounded edge, it kind of already just quiets the drum a little bit.
Right. I mean, the magic for us is in the shell. Yeah, you know, what type of hoop you use, what type of head you use, how much muffling you use, all that stuff can vary right. how much the drum's going to ring. So, if it's your first drum, I'd always say go with the 45. Artists that have 25 drum sets will mix and match because they know what they're doing. I want a baseball bat on the bass drum because I want it to be like sure. that. But I want my floor toms to sing and I want my tom to be like... So
yeah.
they have the luxury of knowing the product line fully. But I think if you're just getting into the brand, I think the 45 is the most versatile.
And then 30 is kind of in between. Those are...
It's like a Gretsch edge, like a vintage yeah. edge, you know. So there's just more wood... shell contact on the drum head.
Right.
So again, I think, you know, I love 30s on mahogany, or, you know, I think 30s have really a great spot on various woods. I think they sound like beach and 30s. I love.
Sure, sure.
You know, 45s, I think, sound best on walnut. If I put a 30 on walnut, I've had one of those that it was just a little too dark, a little too kind of muddy.
I tuned one of those. Actually, it was a Walnut 30. Yeah, I had like, it was like one tom that had those for some reason. It was with a kit. I think the rest of them were 45s, but for whatever
interesting.
Reason it was.
It's different. Yeah, I mean, of course, edges play a big part in the drum's ultimate sound.
Yeah, definitely. It's very important.
But that's, you know, that's why we're resources, and great shops like Maxwell Drums are great resources for customers because we know sure. we've had our hands on so many of these. We kind of know how to advise. And then we have the hybrid edge, which is something we came up with where you can mix a bearing edge. Most popular is a baseball bat on top. So you kind of get that vintagey, thumpy attack with the 45 on the bottom. So
I remember when those started coming in. Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't sacrifice sensitivity or anything like that. You know, it's got its own kind of mojo happening.
Right. Right. Yeah, those are really interesting. You can really dial it in. Yeah, when it comes to those, I'd probably say the BB on top, and then the maybe that's a little bit a 45 on bottom. That's a little bit more for tuning a little higher, maybe. And
yeah.
then the opposite would be good for tuning lower. But that's mm-hmm. just, you know, my opinion.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, we've done baseball bat 30s. We've done 30. You know, we've done them all for people.
Right.
And I've played a number of kits, and they're all very cool. We did the 2-in-1 kit, which featured the baseball bat 45, and it had center-mounted hardware, so you could just turn the bass drum around, just pop the gull wing spur out,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
turn the bass drum around, try a different bearing edge, depending on the room you were playing in.
Sure.
A lot of guys at job actually like that. They think that's a pretty cool feature. Yeah, so, I mean, I think... Again, being small, we can be innovative and push the envelope and try new things.
Right on, right on. And yeah, speaking about that, what's in store for the future? I mean, there have been some really interesting exotic woods lately. Anything cool you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I think Craviato has the private reserve line, which is, you know, the exotic rare woods that we use. And we're going to continue experimenting with that and seeing what we can find.
Sure.
You know, that's not something we proactively produce because we have so many orders in the queue. But as we have the ability to do that, or we take an order for something very special, then of course we make it.
Right.
But yeah, I think we're continuing always experimenting, always thinking about ways to make what we do better or more accessible or whatever. But I think there's some exciting things going on in Nashville structurally. I think they're going to get their own saws. They're going to have wood mills put in, so they're going to be able to control all of the process, as where before we had kind of partners doing some of the resawing. So that's exciting for us. Another exciting thing is trying to bring as much of production back to the U.S. as we can. So we're going to be doing some lugs in the U.S. here again. Again, a portion of that process will be done in-house.
Cool.
So we can really monitor every step of the process and make sure that...
It's the chrome plating. That's the toughest, right?
Well, yeah. We have a great chrome plater and a great partnership in Nashville.
Cool.
Somebody that Sam has used for orchestral stuff and other things over the years. And I've seen their job on a couple drums and was very, very impressed. So that's exciting. So, yeah, I mean, I think we continue to evolve and keep Johnny's legacy alive and add improvements where we can. And, yeah, we're keep it going, man.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, Dave, I think we covered pretty much everything. Anything else you want to go into?
No, I appreciate the opportunity. This is fun.
Sure.
We've been talking about it for some time. Glad we could do it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we at some point we should do another one maybe down the road a while. Maybe we can do one that focuses more on your own influences and your own playing.
yeah, anytime.
Yeah, this one was kind of, Craviato focused.
Sure.
But yeah, I'd love to get into, because you play a lot. You do, yeah, but why don't we do it now?
Okay.
Yeah, you do, right nowadays, you're playing, at least, you said you're doing like shows. Yeah, what are you up to these days?
Yeah, so I do, I play shows, here and there, I play opera, gigs, all sorts of stuff. I freelance,
Sure.
When it works into my schedule and I can. So, I've done theater work, which I really love doing. I think that's a great mix of orchestral and drum set. I did a really fun show called Miracle, which was a drum set book. That blast playing that show. But I have a couple of regional orchestra jobs that I still play.
Nice.
And I think it's great. For me, I can bring Craviato drums out. I can check them out. I can see how they respond in a live musical setting or if I'm, doing any recording or anything like that. It's kind
sure.
of on-the-job experience for me.
Right now, nothing's happening, right?
No, nothing's happening anywhere.
They'll be able to recover some of the smaller orchestras.
That's the question, right? It's a million-dollar question. But
people are going to be so... weird about getting together in big spaces for,
right.
for quite a while, I imagine.
Yeah, I think it's kind of ripped through the arts community in general.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is, we'll see how everybody rebounds. But, I think the groups I plan have a great donor base. And, I think people, instead of going to see a show, maybe are making small donations to some of the smaller arts organizations in their community because they don't want to see those go away. Those are important to people. So
yeah. Right now in these trying times, the people say, "Oh, it's just essential stuff." But the truth is, like the media and art, it is essential.
Right.
What are you doing when you're stuck at home?
Right.
You're watching a movie that has music in it.
Right.
You're listening to music that mm-hmm. Maybe you're listening to a podcast. These are all
right.
things that make our existence pleasant,
I sent a note out to our Craviato artist last week, just saying, how inspired I've become just watching people play and create art, whether it's collaboratively through video cameras
and we're,
streaming
we're
or whatever.
That,
yeah.
I'm talking to my wife about maybe trying to do that with CYSO.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, it's cool. I've seen orchestras do it. I've seen, combos do it. It's really cool. But I think everybody's really itching to get back into a live music environment. Patrons and musicians. I think it's a personal thing.
There's nothing quite like a live show.
No, it's we're human beings and we want to see other people create art and we want to experience that art in a moment, So I think, I don't know. These are kind of crazy times, but you're right. Art is essential. And for me, anytime I'm at home working, I've always worked from home. So this is not that big of a change for me. But
yeah, it's funny for me, too. Like I'm coming here and I'm doing, putting stuff up, doing online. No one's coming into the shop anymore,
right.
but my life hasn't really changed that much.
Right. I've always worked from home, and that's when, there was a time I was traveling out to California about once a month. But otherwise, I was basically working from home. So,
right. What about drummer-wise? Who's a big influence to you?
Oh, I have so many. It just depends on the genre. Who am I listening to now? That's a great question. I should have thought of an answer.
You're on the spot.
I am on the spot. I don't know. I'm kind of an old soul. I listen to a lot of old stuff, you know, just kind of rediscovering things I haven't listened to in a long time. I stumbled upon a couple of Carl Allen records lately.
Okay.
That I've just really been digging. And I know you guys have a DW kit out there for sale that Carl used.
Oh, yeah.
Actually last year's Chicago show. He did a master class.
Yeah, you know,
he's a great player.
I watched some of that. That was really good. Yeah, mm-hmm. that was a fantastic. It's that the Maple kit.
Yeah,
that was. I don't ever get to see any of the clinics, but for whatever reason, I was just up there, and I popped into his, and it was really good. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, Jerome Jennings is another one of our artists that I've been checking out. He's got some great stuff. Tyson Sori.
He's one of our customers. Yeah,
he's a big customer in New York.
I hear his name all the time.
Yeah, I mean, he's just got some amazing things going on, and I mean, there's just so much. I try to listen to something new every day, and just right. Whether it's an orchestral piece by a different orchestra I haven't heard, or whether it's a jazz artist, I try to get fill my head with something.
Do you want to do a shout out for any of the groups you play with?
Sure. Yeah, Northwest Indiana Symphony I play. Chicago Opera Theater I play with regularly. I do a number of subbing with other orchestras.
Once everything gets going again, everybody should try and go support those guys.
There you go.
You'll be supporting Dave.
That's right. Yeah, Paramount Theater out in Aurora. I had a friend playing a show there, and they had to cancel a portion of that run, which is too bad. It was a world premiere of a show, which was going really well. Great band.
They at least get to do it a couple times.
Oh, definitely.
At least it wasn't completely canceled.
Right, but it's sad. Sad to see stuff like that happen. But keeping everybody safe is, most important. So I guess.
Yeah. Our New York shop's completely closed, and then Nashville's completely closed. Here, we're not letting anyone come in unless you work.
Right.
You work in the shop for now, but that's just kind of the way we got to do it.
Right. But
we're still here, though. You can still buy stuff online.
We'll come out of this on stronger for sure.
And
better equipped. So.
Well, yeah, man, that's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Learned a lot about you, and those were really good influences. People that it's so cool doing these interviews because everyone has a different group of people, and I love that. And that's the first time I've heard a couple of those names, and they're really fantastic musicians. Check them out. Maybe I can get some of those guys in here for an interview if we ever have a drum show again.
Yeah, right.
We'll see. Cool, man. Well, Dave, nice check.
Yeah, thanks,
chatting
man.
With you.
You too.
Thanks for listening to everybody.
My pleasure.
Check us out, our website, maxwelldrums.com, and our Reverb store. And hope everyone's being safe out there. Thanks.